Hello, listeners. This is Whit Misseldine, producer of This Is Actually Happening. I started this show 3 years ago because I couldn't imagine a better use of my time than sharing these uncanny, amazing stories with all of you. All 53 episodes have been interviewed, edited, and produced entirely by me and distributed through the Misfit Radio podcast network with no outside sources of funding. It has been a labor of love, and I will keep creating indefinitely regardless of whether or not I have more money for production. However, a little extra cash goes a long way to help me create better, higher quality content. I'm not doing a Kickstarter or Indiegogo campaign, but starting today, I'm providing an opportunity for you to show your support for what I do. So if you feel like kicking in some extra cash for the show, go to permatemp.org. That's permatemp.org. Click on the donate button under the logo and type in whatever amount works for you. Thanks so much for listening, and now on with the episode. This week, it's a wild story from Jupiter, Diego.
Welcome to the Permatemp Corporation. A presentation of the audio podcast, This Is Actually Happening. Episode 54. What if you lost a high-speed car chase?
I used to be a terrible cocaine addict. Really, I started as a teenager, but it was never chronic. It was intermittent. It was periodic. But it was always intense. I mean, I always went big. When under the influence of cocaine, one naturally has only one prevailing agenda, and that is more. It's a fucked up drug. I love it. The rush, especially from a large dose of high content, high purity cocaine, it is like having instant and non-stop sex immediately and without interruption for several hours. What's not to like is what comes afterwards. The paranoia, hallucinations, the insomnia, the self-loathing, the loss of one's entire self-esteem and self-worth. Everything that may be important to you in life has all been completely replaced by a white powder. At the time of this story, I was 35. I had been married for 8 years at the time of this story. We had been in therapy in an attempt to save our marriage, which was being decimated by my flagrant, irresponsible, and destructive cocaine use, which had become less and less intermittent and more a chronic daily feature of my so-called life. On this particular occasion, my wife and I, had gone to our marriage counselor, and we had a tradition of going out to dinner after each of our weekly therapy sessions. On this particular occasion, we had taken two cars to the therapist's office, and I left in a huff before she did, and I drove straight home locked and chained the front door so she would not have access, barricaded myself in the garage, and proceeded to snort an entire 8-ball of really good cocaine within a matter of minutes. Now, an 8-ball is an eighth of an ounce. It's approximately 3.5 grams. It's enough cocaine to last a person a whole week. And I did it in maybe 5 minutes. And when she got home and was unable to get in the house, she knocked on the neighbor's door and asked the fellow to help her. And they went around the alley and couldn't get in that way either. And finally, he scaled the wall and let her in. And they found me wet, naked, under a mountain of humid blankets on the concrete floor of the garage. Apparently, I thought that was a clever hiding place and that nobody would find me because I was stoned out of my mind. I emerged naked and dripping with sweat and somehow persuaded my wife to go forward with our usual tradition of going out to dinner in spite of my state. We went to Beverly Hills to the Carnegie Deli. When we sat down, I wanted desperately to come down from the Coke. So I excused myself to go to the men's room. And on the way, I found our server. I slipped her a $50 bill and asked her to prepare a tall glass of scotch upon my exit from the men's room and to not let my wife see this. So when I came out of the men's room, there was not just a glass of scotch, it was a 12-ounce water glass filled to the brim with scotch. I downed the whole thing, managed to somehow make it back to the table, banging into things, etc. And as I sat down, I went into what can only be described as a blackout, because for the next 10 or 15 minutes, I can only tell you what was told to me. I stood up and started shouting at the elderly couple at the table next to us. I grabbed her strawberry milkshake and poured it down her blouse, and then began to run around the restaurant, grabbing patrons' dishes and entrees and flinging them across the room like so many frisbees, and created quite a scene. I'm told that I then very angrily threw a $100 bill down on the floor and stormed out of the restaurant. At this point, my recollection begins to come back to me. I'm walking up Beverly Drive with the remote clicker to our car, clicking left and right, trying to hear a beep to locate our car, since I don't remember where we've parked it. And I come upon a valet parking lot. They happen to have an SUV, very much like ours, the same dark green color, motor running, and the driver's side door open. The valet says to me, "Your car, sir?" I said, "Well, yeah." And as I attempt to climb into the car, I fall back out and land on my butt with a thud. And does this prevent the valet from helping me into the car? No, in fact, he picks me up physically, lifts me into the driver's seat, and I'm on my way. I drive out of the lot onto Beverly Drive, and at this very moment, I see two Beverly Hills squad cars coming right towards me. They immediately recognize me because I'm wearing a red beret and a bushy goatee, which no doubt had been described by the restaurant manager when she called the cops because I was disturbing the peace. So they immediately flip on their lights and sirens. I took this as my cue to jam down on the gas. I turn right onto Brighton Way. Now, Brighton Way in downtown Beverly Hills is a one-way street, and I am going the wrong way. And then, all of a sudden, two more squad cars join the chase, one from the left, one from the right. A police helicopter swoops down, and I have the big beam of light on the hood of the stolen car that I'm driving. I get to the east end of the Platinum Triangle. Two more squad cars, now a total of six, are chasing me up and down through the primary downtown business district of Beverly Hills. There is no inclination whatsoever to do the rational or responsible thing, to surrender, to pull over, to give up. The only thing I'm thinking as all of these cars are chasing me is I need to get away. It is pure fright and flight. I'm driving as fast as I can, not only weaving between the cars, but jumping up on the curbs, driving on the sidewalk. I flip the car in one last desperate move, 180 degrees, to attempt an escape. But the vehicle flips onto its roof, hanging upside down, but still belted into my seat. I see now in front of me a semicircle of 10 Beverly Hills police officers, their service pistols all pointed straight at my head. There's a fire engine in the background, an ambulance. The helicopter is still making circles around, and a crowd of nearly 200 people has assembled. And at this moment, I had a moment of clarity. I didn't exactly have a sense of self-preservation. Having the whole windshield crash in on me, the helicopter, the crowd, the fire engine, the ambulance, and 10 cops with their guns all pointed at me, it kind of shocks you into a different state. It was like, oh shit, this is real. This is actually happening. This is not just a fantasy. This is not just a joke like the rest of my life had become. This is real. You're about to be dead. I think that's what gave birth to, or shall I say, uncovered this slight remnant, this artifact of self-preservation that somehow was still extant, still living somewhere in my brain or my body. It was snatched to the fore, and here was this tiny little remnant of self-preservation instinct where I was like, oh, fuck. This is the end of my life. I am literally about to be dead. Knowing this, the act of surrender that no doubt saved my life was to push my hands forward, fingers spread as wide as possible through that broken out windshield, and to very clearly, calmly, and slowly announce, 10 fingers, no gun. And I have no doubt that one singular action saved my life. At this point, the cops, guns still pointed straight at my head and my heart, slowly converged in on me, and I was handcuffed and taken away. And now when you put cocaine and alcohol together, it forms a new metabolite, a third chemical called cocaethylene in your body. And I didn't know this, and my wife had caught up with us, and here I was with the two cops in the hospital. They were wanting to get my blood drawn to see what my blood alcohol content was. But the nurses informed them that because my blood pressure was so astronomically high that it was not safe to draw my blood and they would have to wait. So several hours went by, which I thought was great because this would give my body a chance to metabolize the alcohol and possibly bring my blood alcohol content down below the legal limit, the ceiling of 0.08%. No such luck. When they finally did draw my blood, it was found to nevertheless be triple the legal limit at 2.4. Furthermore, and worse, they sent a second vial off to UCLA for analysis, where it was determined several days later that my levels of cocaine and cocaethylene were lethal, and that the lab director had mistakenly made the assumption that I was at the morgue and was surprised to hear that I was very much alive. After the hospital, I was taken to the Beverly Hills jail and put into the drunk tank with about 20 men. Half of them were transsexuals wearing dresses and high heels. It was out of a Hieronymus Bosch painting. It was hideous. And yet, strangely beautiful, vomiting, shitting, screaming, sweating, masturbating, kissing, petting, all around me. They had a steel toilet with no privacy enclosure in one corner of the room. I was sitting next to this one couple of men who were making out, and I asked in all sincerity why they had done this to themselves, why they had gone to such lengths to not just cross-dress but to change their bodies. This aroused an angry response from half a dozen of the nearby men who assumed I was being hostile and judgmental. But one of the two men, a very petite man in a beautiful red Dior cocktail dress and Ferragamo pumps, jumped up and announced, he's just curious and he's being honest and we owe him our respect for that. And then, looking me straight in the eyes, he said, the reason I have chosen to grow breasts and the reason I wear a dress is because it makes me feel good about myself. This was such a refreshingly complete answer. It aroused my total empathy and compassion and support. The others took a step back and, letting go of their hostility, came forward then and gave me hugs. It was a most unusual and transcendent moment of acceptance. After some hours, two sergeants appeared and took me away to be processed and led to my cell. The cells at the Beverly Hills Jail are immaculate. They have porcelain toilets, they're not steel. The people are nice. But I was not in a stable frame of mind, to say the least. And I tried to drown myself in the toilet. This did not amuse them at all. And so I was transported, shackled at both the ankles and wrists, and I ended up spending 5 days and nights in my suicide watch solitary confinement cell, which, by the way, does not have a nice pillow and mattress. They give you a rubber blanket, which cannot be made into a noose. And they watch you continuously. They keep the temperature so cold that there's no thought of rebellion. All the inmates in that unit stay huddled under their rubber blankets, searching for whatever warmth they can find. On the fourth day, I was told I had a visitor. The visitor was my wife and an attorney, a very fancy pants lady, high powered attorney, who announced to me immediately with a big cheerful grin. She said, good news! I've gotten your $250,000 bail reduced to just $35,000. And the four felonies, driving under the influence, evading police, under the influence of cocaine, and grand theft auto, I've had them all reduced to misdemeanors. Now, it's still four counts, and you still have to come up with the $35,000 bail. But I think that's really good news. Ultimately, I was released on condition that I would be checked in the same day to the Cedars-Sinai Chemical Dependency Unit. My wife brought me home. We packed a bag. I was taken to the hospital. I was searched yet again and checked in. And that turned out to be 30 of the most enjoyable, sunny, and fun-filled days of my life. Everyone there was a cokehead, a junkie, or a pill freak. I felt right at home. At the end of my 30 days, I was taken to see Judge Eldon Fox at the Beverly Hills Courthouse. Judge Fox was and remains judge to the stars. He was the judge for Lindsay Lohan, Winona Ryder. He gave me a lot of credit for having completed the 30 days in rehab at Cedars. And the prosecuting attorney, who was a lady, cut a deal in the ladies' room with my fancy pants attorney, and they agreed together to drop all the charges except one, misdemeanor DUI. I was sentenced to the 5 days I had already served in the county jail, given summary probation, and released on my own recognizance. A week later, my attorney came to discuss payment of her $10,000 fee. Now, I didn't have money, anything remotely like that. And of course, she had done her job with excellence. There was no question she deserved that $10,000. But before I had a chance to start pleading poverty or asking to make some kind of payment arrangements, she looked around my living room and admired one of my paintings. I'm an artist. I had my paintings and photographs all around the house. She particularly liked this one oil painting, and she asked if she could take that painting with her in lieu of her fee. This was astonishing. Believe it or not, this is true. That painting hangs today between a Picasso etching on the right and a Jackson Pollock piece, a lithograph, on the left in her private collection in New York. All I can say is there's no accounting for some people's taste.